This is Outstanding in the Field, a podcast by Perennia highlighting production practices, pest management, and more for field crops in Nova Scotia. I'm your host and provincial field crop specialist, Caitlin Condon. On this episode, I'm joined by our first repeat guest, Dan McCachran. Dan is a biologist at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, where he works out of the Harrington Research Farm on Prince Edward Island. Dan is joining me today to discuss a trial he led on management strategies for increasing corn test wheat. All right, welcome back, Dan. You are actually my first repeat podcast guest. So,
oh wow,
happy to have you here.
It's nice to be here. Thanks, Caitlin.
Great. Today we're going to talk about a project that you had on for the last several years, looking at management strategies for test wheat. Is that the best title for it?
You know, we've gone through. Yeah, that's pretty darn good. We've gone through a few titles, but that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
We're just trying to improve test weight or grain quality.
Yeah, for corn. I should specify. Yep. So I guess before we kind of get into any of that, I do just want to make a distinction between test weight and kernel weight, because both of those terms get thrown around for people. So test weight is the weight of a certain volume of grain, while kernel weight would be the weight of a certain number of kernels. So they're related, but they're not the same thing. Today we're talking about test weight specifically.
Yeah, let's get it done.
Let's do it. All right. So I guess before we talk too much about the trial, let's talk a little bit about the importance of test weight. Obviously, we're using that as, you know, it goes into the grading process. That's how we know what kind of quality we're getting out of our grain corn. So what's the importance of that, and what's the opportunity to increase test weights, and why would that be beneficial for maritime farmers?
Well, test weight is important, Caitlin, because it's an indicator of grain quality. Like you say, a higher density kernel has more energy and therefore it has a higher feed value. So, you know, we're trying to achieve higher test weights in Atlantic Canada in general. You asked about, you know, what's the opportunity of increasing test weight, and I think it's pretty good. That's not to say that I think our producers are doing anything wrong when it comes to growing corn, but grain corn, or the growth of grain corn, is becoming increasingly more prevalent here as a cash crop. You know, we always had dairy producers, you know, growing corn, not necessarily grain corn, but
no, a lot of silage.
Yeah, and they're trying to produce, you know, a good quality corn, but now we have a lot of people that may have had, they have experience growing other crops, but they may not have necessarily had a lot of experience growing corn. So,
yeah, totally.
And I think if we were to go back to the Atlantic Grains Council put out some stats, but essentially our corn acreage here in Atlantic Canada has really increased over the last number of years. So, and yeah, a lot definitely. Of those are inexperienced corn growers. So I think that there's just there's a lot of opportunity just to, you know, produce better quality corn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree. And like you said, it's traditionally we're pretty used to growing silage corn, but the test weight's not something that we're ever thinking about with silage corn. So it's good to look at these things and kind of see where we can improve. And what we can do differently to kind of make the best product.
I think Caitlin, in a lot of cases, you know, it's just tweaking. Like
totally.
The corn they may be growing is great corn, but if they want it, there are a few tweaks I think that they can make in order to meet, you know, certain market demands. So,
yeah. And I think it's interesting too, from the perspective of, like, obviously test weight's important when you're selling corn. But even when it's being used on farm, where that higher test weight kind of corresponds to, you know, a higher quality feed as well. So even if you're not selling it, it's still going to be a beneficial thing for your on-farm use.
Well, even shipping. So mm-hmm. like a high test weight ships better. You can pack a lot more. It packs better. You can ship a lot more weight. There's a lot of uses.
Lots of benefits.
Lots of benefits, that's the word.
Cool. So let's talk about the actual trial. What were the objectives? When did it start? How many years of data do we have? And
All that. So the objectives was pretty straightforward. So using like common hybrids, mm-hmm. and I always chose hybrids that were listed on our recommendation list because we knew that they were readily available to everyone. So using those hybrids, could we improve quality here in Atlantic Canada by making just a few minor changes? So, you know, we know that there's a lot of things that affect your corn crop, mm-hmm. And we couldn't choose everything. So we just decided to go with nitrogen source. We thought we'd test three different nitrogens. This was at the start of the project back in 2018. Mm-hmm. So we were trying ammonium nitrate, UAN, urea ammonium nitrate, and an ammonium sulfate. Then we also wanted to try a split application where we went in with just one top dress at V4, or we mm-hmm. went in and we split it up. So we went in at V4 and again at R1. Mm-hmm. We also wanted to try hybrid, of course. So we tested a range of hybrids, Caitlin, going from around 2100 up to 2650 mm-hmm. In heat units or crop heat units. And then we also... We had a few producers come to us with questions about row plastic, and mm-hmm. so we just thought we'd throw that in there. So we threw a lot of things at the wall just to see what would stick, and that was the purpose. Like I say, we couldn't test everything all at once, but I think we did. It was pretty interesting, some of our findings, so it worked out
for sure. Well, and we'll get into it more later, but, you know, being able to test so many different things and kind of try some of those kind of weirder things like the plastic is one of the big benefits of doing the small plot research, to be able to kind of test drive it before it, you know, to make sure that it's, you know, it may not ever be reasonable in the real world, but that's why we do it here, to kind of weed it out.
Yeah, small plots. And You get these questions probably all the time in your extension work, and I know that I've been asked a lot, like how translatable are the results from small plot work to mm-hmm. what's happening on farm, and you know, it kind of depends on mm-hmm. on the farm that's going to be growing them and whether or not their conditions are similar to the conditions where the plots were grown.
Yeah.
So. You know, huge advantages, though. We wouldn't be where we're at today with agriculture research if we didn't have the small plot stuff going on. And like you say, that's where we take our risky stuff, our risky treatments, and we'll try them out on a small scale, because you don't want to take those and head right out and do, you know, 100 acres.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily even be 100 acres. It could, you know, be 10 acres. It's same.
But thing. Man, even 10 acres of putting down that plastic would be a big old pain.
And corn seed isn't cheap, so nothing's cheap. Nothing's fertilizer, cheap. Everything.
Exactly. Cool. So this started in 2018. You have 4 years of data, is that right? 3-4 years?
We have the total number of site years. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. It's a lot. So essentially, we're getting three site years a year. Mm-hmm. So then that adds up quite quickly. So like from our findings, I think we're pretty confident. You know, we have quite a bit of data. This study has been, like I say, it's amazing how fast time flies.
No, I didn't realize that that's when it started. So
I can't believe we've been working on this that long. I know. And it's not over yet. Like there'll always be questions. So we have some cool stuff coming.
always evolving. So, and you did this in multiple locations. So we had a location down here in the Valley, but your other locations were in PEI and New Brunswick.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. We have our research farm here in Harrington, we're lucky to have it, and we have lots of equipment. So that's one site. Knightville, New Brunswick is the other site. And then,
we usually have a corn variety trial in that same area. So that's kind of cool to be able to draw those parallels.
Yeah.
No, awesome. So you're covering lots of different conditions, lots of different geography there across the region.
Yeah, we're covering what we can. It can be challenging sometimes given the number of treatments that we have to find collaborators that are that are willing to grow a trial like this, across the region. So we're lucky to find folks like yourself who can take it on and do it so successfully.
Yeah, well, it's interesting stuff. Okay, so I guess we'll dive into the actual, what did we see? What did you see out of this? You kind of mentioned some of the treatments were, but let's, I guess, talk about fertility source first.
Okay. For fertility source, well, when it came to, like I say, for the first part of the trial, we tried a few different treatments and we changed it up for the last 2 years of the trial. So I mentioned the three sources and basically, we didn't see a whole pile of difference between the ammonium nitrate in the UAN when it came to improving the test weights. But we did see a significant increase when it came to the ammonium sulfate.
Right.
As well as the plastic. I know the plastic isn't fertility source, and the plastic utilized just our control fertility, which was 150 units of ammonium nitrate. But yeah, we definitely saw something happening with the ammonium sulfate, and that made us want to dig into things a little more later on. When it came to yield, the ammonium sulfate just really stood out. And so what we did is that the total units of nitrogen for that treatment, it was 150, but only 100 came from ammonium sulfate. We put 50 down at planting, and that was as ammonium nitrate. Now, this is when ammonium nitrate was readily available. It's a little bit trickier to find now. So we evolved in the latter 2 years, and we started using, calcium ammonium nitrate. Mm-hmm. Anyway, to get back there, then amongst the other fertility sources, when it came to yield, we didn't see a significant difference between like the liquid UAN and the granular ammonium nitrate. As well, when it came to like the split applications, we didn't notice any big difference there. No significant difference in yield or test weight. And so I guess what is significant there is that, if you go in with a single application, you're not going in trying to do a top dress. It's kind of an awkward timing, which R1 can be.
For sure. Especially with the equipment that you tend to have available.
Yeah, exactly. But, that's why we try this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do this research on small scale just to see if it would be worthwhile to start, doing that. So,
yeah, definitely. So sulfur seemed to be the, kind of the key where you did start to see some differences.
Yeah, no, we were definitely seeing some differences there. So then we were like, Caitlin, we'd like to try to dial in because the rate of sulfur that we were applying was not realistic at all.
It was a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. So if you're, ammonium sulfate is 21,0024. So when we're putting down to get to achieve our 100 units of nitrogen, That meant that we were getting 114 units of sulfur, which is pretty
crazy amount of sulfur.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, we just thought we'd try to dial in from there.
Yeah.
What that did is that it brought us into the next phase of the project.
Yeah.
And so we changed up our treatments, and we broke it up so that we had we were testing right from the 114, that which we were calling it our very high level, and then we went down and we tested 80 units of sulfur, 45, 34, 25, and as low and 10 as well as zero.
Right.
And we were hoping like, well, let's see what happens. We should be able to figure it out there now. And since we were doing that and revamping things and knowing that ammonium sulfate, was no longer available, we decided to test CAN. We also tested ESN and Agritane.
Yep.
And then we tested at two rates, so at 150 and 200 units of N.
So when you looked at the different rates of sulfur, were there differences in test weights there?
Yes. So we did notice a bit of a change in test weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when it comes to test weight and sulfur, we did notice that there was an increase. At first, there was a significant increase right around once we hit the 45 kilograms per hectare. We saw an increase in test weight. The second year kind of drowned that out a little bit. So then what it turned into was a nice trend. Mm-hmm. But regardless, we were seeing benefits for test weight around the 45 kilograms per hectare level.
That seems much more reasonable than a 114.
Yeah, no, definitely. And when it comes to yield, it was the same thing, Caitlin. That 45 mark really seemed to be the key number. But right. The thing is that we're not always going to see that every year. Like
right.
The sulfur that's available to plants it's very variable. It's a mobile nutrient. It's similar to nitrogen in that respect, and that it can easily leach away.
Yeah.
But we can also get sulfur quite readily as well through like atmospheric deposition. So,
right.
Rain and absorption from the air right directly to the soil. Those are sources of additional sulfur, which can definitely affect what you see from year to year.
And so, like in the past, we would have had more of that sulfur, especially in like rain and stuff, right? Than we are seeing now. So maybe that's
We'll see. Definitely. See, we never had to worry about sulfur in the past,
right?
We always heard about acid rain, and it hasn't gone away, but it is not as significant as it was, say, back in the 80s. So, I guess legislation is kind of responsible for this. A lot of companies now install buffers on their smokestacks and our scrubbers. And they're scrubbing the sulfur out to improve, their emissions. Yes. And this has made a big difference for us, where in the past we could easily see as much as 30 kilograms per hectare or more per year of atmospheric deposition. Yeah,
right.
we're not seeing that as much anymore. It kind of depends where you're at.
For sure.
If you are close to industry, someplace that's emitting a lot, you can definitely have higher levels in that vicinity, and also different parts of the world with different regulations.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I guess I was gonna go off the map a little bit again here. I apologize.
Sure.
Did you do any, did you look at the economics of it at all, of the sulfur?
No.
Okay.
I haven't, and that's something that we're going to do in the near future. Yeah. And we're very well aware that it all boils down to the economics, of course. Yeah. But we hope to be doing that sometime in the near future.
Cool. Yeah. No, that'll be interesting to see where, you know, the 45 units of sulfur, kind of where that sits in terms of economic feasibility. So we'll stay tuned for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So did you see any other kind of notable trends over the life of the trial? I know some of the treatments changed and stuff like that, but anything else that kind of popped out over those years?
Well, I guess one thing, the mid-range heat unit corns usually performed quite a bit better in terms of yield and test weight. So when I say that, this might not be mid-range in any other part of the world, but it is here.
So it is for us.
For us. It's about around the 2300 to 2400 mark. Yeah. Right. That seemed to perform much better. And probably a couple of reasons, like it boils down to getting that crop mature.
Mm-hmm.
Know that yourself. And I know over here on Prince Edward Island, we're subject to random frosts once the end of August, or you're near the end of August, you just never know what could happen. And so, like, for instance, in the past, I had two fields of corn. One was just sitting a little bit lower here on the farm, and one field was a little bit higher elevation. And one night, one lower elevation field got hit pretty hard.
Mm.
And what does that do when your corn isn't quite done, quite finished maturing? Well, that frost kind of seals the deal if it's strong enough, and then all of a sudden your test weight building is done. And right. So
cut off the knees.
Yeah, cut off the knees. And so, you know, in that instance, if you're growing something like a 2600 corn, odds are it's not going to be quite as far along as that 2300 that you were growing. So
yeah, and that goes for frost, but it would go for, I mean, the past couple of years, we've had some hurricanes and significant storms kind of in that mid to late September period. And that would do a similar thing, you know, if it's knocking the corn down and breaking the stalk, then we're halting maturity. So,
100%. And that makes me think, like, standability is a thing. And it's
totally.
Definitely something to ask your seed salesperson about, or to check stock breakage and stuff like that when it comes to the corn guide. Like, look at all those values. Because, like, when we're testing different hybrids, you'll go and you'll see one that after, like, well, a hurricane comes through, you see one that's flat, and then you see one that's, well, just not as flat, but that can that makes a huge difference when you've got to clean up that field.
Oh, definitely.
You know, so.
And it could make the difference between, you know, if you were planning to take it for high moisture or grain corn versus the only thing you can do with it now is chop it for silage.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And your trial did actually go through Hurricane Fiona. I remember at our site down in the valley, you know, trying to pick up the stalks to harvest them. Oh,
I remember it as well. It comes back as a nightmare.
I'm sure.
From time to time. But yeah, and we had to, the corn wasn't finished then. So we lost some data that year for sure.
Yeah.
Because it was just, it was
And
gone.
I think we had a fairly high heat unit one down in the valley that year, so it definitely wasn't done.
Yeah.
So we talked about kind of why it's important to look at these things in small plot research. So how do we then not just this particular project, but in general, we're doing things in kind of small plot research. And how do we then take that and decide what gets scaled up into field scale or, you know, farm level research?
Yeah. Well,
or practice.
Yeah. Well, we look at the numbers, which treatment was successful. And like you said, you look at the economics. Does it seem to work out on paper, say, to be applying 45 units of sulfur? Is it feasible, like in terms of the equipment and stuff that you have? And yes, in this case, it definitely would be. And so just from there, you spread the word, and producers will start adopting it slowly. But in order to help that, you know, this project was funded by the Atlantic Grains Council, and they have their on-farm agronomy program, or they had it going for the last number of years. And so, you know, that's just an excellent way to move the findings from our research out into a more, you know, practical setting.
Sure. And
to see how it works out.
Yeah. No, I'm a big big fan of like test strips on farms. Yeah. Just, you know, if you're looking at trying something a little new, a little different, whether it's a new product or looking at different rates of fertilizer or whatever.
Yep.
That's just a really easy way to be able to see in your field side-by-side comparison of, is this benefiting me?
Yeah.
This particular year. And like, obviously, like you said, it's kind of those results gain more strength the more years you have behind them. But it's nice to be able to see it just side by side in your field.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, like we said here earlier, when it came to the small plot stuff, our small plot work, it's representative of the areas that we tested. You know, we can really control things. That's the benefit of them. You know, so the site that you grew, you know, when you grew it out for us down in Nova Scotia, and our collaborators over in New Brunswick, you know, we had some soil differences, maybe a little bit of precipitation differences, but everything else was exactly the same.
Yeah.
So when you're moving that out on farm, you know, oh my God, there's just a huge range, huge variability.
Yeah.
So that's where it's handy to do what you said, is like when it comes to hybrids, grow some strips and see how they perform in given your farm's conditions. Because your farm is going to be different from your neighbor's farm, and definitely different from the person quite a bit, you know, down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next for small plot field crops research in the Maritimes? Do you have anything on the go that you want to chat about, or?
Yeah, well, we have some things, and they're just starting out. So we don't have any results yet, but this is the type of stuff you can look forward to from myself as well as our collaborators. One, I'm working with Dr. Tandra Fraser, who's a soil microbiologist here at the center. And we have one project on the go looking at biostimulants in corn.
It's a hot topic right now.
Yeah, it seems to be. So we hope to provide a little bit of data there.
Awesome.
I also have a project starting up this spring, looking at corn tillage and row spacing. So we plan on looking at conventional tillage, no-till, reduced till, and as well as strip tilling.
Nice.
And using some different row spacing. So we're going to try, you know, just a regular 30-inch rows, but we also want to narrow that down to 20 and possibly even 15.
Wow.
And just see what happens there. Also, one of my colleagues over here, Dr. Andrew McKenzie Gopsel, he has a cool corn project where he's looking at some of the seeing what the best cover crops to grow with corn would be, looking at the understory species. Nice. There. So that will be neat. Then we're working, I'm on a project with Dr. Yunfei Jiang with Dalhousie, and she has a project, and it's an assessment of enhanced efficiency fertilizers in corn. So
nice.
That will likely utilize, you know, a couple of the nitrogens I had tested there, you know, in my project, and so we'll probably carry that on. But looking forward to that. And then I believe the Atlantic Rains Council has Corn Yen starting up. And so I'm going to be part of that.
That is the hope. Yeah, I think that'll be super interesting. I'm really looking forward to, I know they kind of trialed the soybean yen on the island in 2023. So yeah, really looking forward to being able to expand outside of the cereals that we have been doing. Because then we'll be able to follow a field over multiple years in a row, which will be super cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a great opportunity for farmers to try to adopt some of the things that we've found, because oftentimes when farmers are when they join Yen, they're not, you know, they're obviously they're not putting their entire farm in. They're maybe putting one field and then they'll experiment a bit. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's just worked out tremendously well with the wheat and barley, and hope it does for the corn as well.
Well, I think that's all the questions I had for you. Okay. Unless you have anything else you want to mention or talk about.
No. We will be presenting some of this work, Caitlin, at the Cereals and Oilseeds Conference, which is coming up in Summerside, PEI, I believe, on this 5th and 6th or 6th and 7th?
6th and 7th, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of March,
yep.
Yep. So if you want to talk about this a little more and get into it a little bit more in depth, I'll be there.
Be kicking
and
around.
And you'll be there also.
I will, yes. Yeah. It'll be a good time, I think. It looks like a really good lineup for the conference.
Sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for chatting about this project and being a repeat guest on the podcast. Very exciting.
Oh, thanks, Caitlin. It was a lot of fun to be here.
Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Outstanding in the Field. During the episode, we mentioned the Cereal and Oilseed Conference being held in early March 2024 in Summerside, PEI, where Dan is on the agenda to present more on this project. I believe the conference sessions are going to be recorded and available after the fact, so I will link that in the show notes when it is available in case you'd like to hear more about this project. Follow us on social media at NS Perennia and subscribe to the podcast to stay up to date on future episodes. Thanks to Perennia for supporting this podcast and to Rachel Ochsner from our marketing and communications team for podcast production.